So good. Back to the Beit Midrash. This is our Talmud learning. We're in Masechet Ta'anit, and we're going to start today's learning on 7-8-3. I want to really call this a part of the Gemara that's, you know, it's wonderfully, on the one hand, you could say a gutic, but it's not just built on Masim Shehayu. It's not necessarily tales. We're in this section where we're talking about this culture of Torah and the importance of Torah and Torah learning. And the rabbis are comparing days of rain to wonderful days in the history of the world and all that's granted through the rains coming for the earth. Well, all that's granted to the world through Torah being in the world and the Chachamim and the sages investing their lives in Torah and all that gains for the world is really, I think, the way that they're seeing this conversation expand. Again, establishing rabbinic culture, and we're still in that, we started it last time, notion of the importance of Torah, Torah scholars, Torah study, and the Torah as a tree of life. And, you know, it's igniting the Torah scholars, it's sharpening them, and the Torah scholars are like irons and sharpening one another with their arguments and with their positions and their teachings. And we're going to go in the middle of the left-hand side of the page, Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa Rame. Chanina Bar Papa contrasted the two verses. It's written in one place, Likrat Sameh Hitayumayim, bring water to the thirsty. A teacher should go to the student to teach him Torah. Uchativ, but in another verse it's written, Hayi kolt same lechulamayim, everyone that is thirsty, go to the water. We saw this contrast between those who would be thirsty and needing to go, and those who really as a student should welcome their teachers, but the teachers have the obligation to go out to the people. So I bring you this little passage again just to mention that I had an interesting discussion with folks over time in terms of Torah and the way we do Torah teaching. We were just talking about classes and Torah learning and text learning in the community. You could use this small passage to fundamentally describe two different approaches going on in the world today in our time, which is grounded in historical realities such as the Gemara that we're learning, and comes to be expressed by the Jewish community in over different generations. What kind of fundamental approaches to Torah study am I talking about? These two are fundamental approaches to Torah study and learning, and kind of shopping Judaism around versus putting it in a store and letting people come into the store. Right? You have the outreach movement throughout the history of the Jewish people. You have the outreach movement of today. If you say, capital O, the outreach movement of today, you do have in consciousness, in Jewish consciousness, a movement that believes that Torah needed to be brought forward to the people where they were, on the streets, in the cafes, out in storefronts. It wasn't just a center of Jewish learning that needed to be established and you hung the sign and said, you know, please come still, but that you needed to come into the Beit Midrash. You needed to sign up for the class and come inside. So that was fundamentally expressed by the Lubavitcher Rebbe in Europe at wartime and even before, where there was this idea that European Jews and Jewry really would need an outreach approach. You see that today. I mean, the big expression is in New York. I don't have to tell you like what outreach looks like by some of the biggest outreach agencies we have, right? Everything from mitzvah tanks to the more liberal programs in Starbucks and bars that purport to be, at least, Torah-based learning. But more than that, like, outreach in people's office places, maybe there's a lunchtime shiur, and you bring a rabbi from such and such organization, and you let the shiur leader, the rabbi or not a rabbi, bring Torah into the marketplace of the Jewish people, versus a very kind of closed idea about classes, which might mean that, oh, maybe only Jewish studies classes were offered at the Jewish Theological Seminary and YU and inside an institution that might offer the class. That's a kind of approach that says, well, let's establish those institutions and let's have Jews really say, yes, I'm supportive, I want to learn, I want to support learning, in the same way Meir, you expressed it beautifully, both to learn and to support learning is an ideal within the Jewish community. Some yeshivot, as I said, it's come to expression in the past, some yeshivot really believed that the towns around them should send the ilui, should send the one who was the smartest, and those folks could come and they could be the yeshiva bachers. And the rest of the folks should learn what it means to be a tailor or be a schlepper or whatever you want to say the person could do in life. And it wasn't the kind of thing where you saw in the middle of the cafe any kind of Torah learning. That wasn't an ideal. There wasn't a popularization of Torah and Torah learning and Torah discovery in those kinds of places throughout history in Eastern Europe. Maybe a little bit as certain educators became a little bit more interested in bringing masses of people to the well of Torah if it was at all really a popular movement. People say that in a certain way Hasidim made things more popular. They probably made mystical ideas more popular than simply Torah study in and of itself. They popularized, if they popularized anything, mystical ideas that they then implanted within normative kinds of Jewish, traditional Jewish approaches in the world. But you had some magids who went around telling Jewish stories. Those were of interest. And you did have certain kinds of nods to, you know, we can't call them major centers of drama production, but you had sometimes a community gather around and listen to someone say more about the Torah portion than at other times, and gave great lectures and homiletics in certain communities, 16th century Italy. Homiletics were so important that people would gather in the synagogue, not just on a Sabbath, and not just on a Yontif. They really respected the art of the delivery of a homily in some of those communities, and we have some history like that. So I'm just pointing to the fact that bringing people in versus meeting them where they are is already an idea that's expressed on page 7 of our Gemara. Similar theme, at the bottom of the page, Rabbi Hanina Bar Chama, Rameh. Eric, actually, I happen to have an extra Gemara. Thank you. Is that right? You can come in late if you need to come in late. We welcome anyone to the Beit Midrash. The gates are not closed.
I hear.
Okay, so bottom of 7A3, left-hand side. So it's written, Yafutsu Mayanotecha Chutza. Your wellspring shall spread outwards. In other words, you shall teach Torah to others. Uchativ, but it's written, Yehiyu Lecha Levadecha. They shall be for you alone, and don't really share it with others. Now, whether or not they're talking about true strangers or not, kind of comes through looking at what these laws are really about. Is it a matter of sharing Torah ideas with those who are not Jewish, and you're supposed to go out and proselytize? That's another possibility for talking about what's this framework talking about. You're supposed to teach it to the inside, meaning to people who are Jewish, and not teach it so much to people who are not Jewish? Or are you supposed to really go out and really make inroads into potential communities of converts? So that's another possibility of what this is saying here, and another approach, potentially, which is why the Gemara brings the second look. Im Talmid Hagunhu, if the student's a proper character, Yafutsu Mayinotecha Chutza, your wellspring shall spread outwards towards him. V'im Lav, they shall be for you alone. So what will make Torah readily accessible and available and wonderfully regarded in the world around us? Not only if the person is of great Torah learning, but if the person is of great Torah character. And we talked about this last time. Barry brought up the observation that it was, you know, somewhat surprising. And I agree that they were so open to talking about how a sage could be of questionable character versus being someone of a beautiful, wonderful Torah manner, let's say. But that's definitely the weave of what's going on here. If the person is a Torah personality and a mensch of a guy, a mention, and we're talking about a guy in this case, the Gemara for sure, then it could be not only his alone, but he could wind up sharing it, whether it's sharing with other Jews on an outreach basis like the movement I was talking about, or into a community where there are potential converts, or just as a matter of sharing ideas in the world of religious ideas and ideals. Then it's wonderful, but if you're not so able to do that because of your character, then, you know, let it be for you alone.
Okay, so since you had already brought up Hasidus, this is Hashem Tov asked Mashiach, when are you going to come? And the answer is L'shei Futsu Mayinu Sech L'chutz. So, what's the point? Which interpretation is that one taking?
Nice.
Is it saying that all of Israel is worthy?
Tell Bobby the answer. Tell Bobby the answer.
In English,
we'll I'm so sorry. Baal Shem Tov asked Mashiach, when are you going to come? And Mashiach's answer is this verse, when your wells have, when your teaching, in other words, has spread forth, but using this verse.
So I would say that's at the heart of and the backbone of what Chabad Chassidus believes today.
Sure.
That not only, if we take approach A, that it's about reaching out and spreading out that Mayan, sharing those living waters of Torah with our people wherever they are, right? But even that the Jewish ideas and ideals should permeate creation, and that's part of what it means to be a Mamlechet Kohanim, that we serve humanity in that way. Now, that's a pretty big Jewish ideal. Some people may take it as being a little bit, let's say,
arrogant,
chutzpahdik. I was thinking that it's hubris. On the other hand, to imagine that you really have that kind of responsibility, and that there are ideals that could potentially really help change and shape the world, and take that responsibility seriously and be humble about it, that's the challenge of what this is all about. You know? Understand how profound a responsibility that could be. Do it with humility, and the world could change. You know, I find that to be a very powerful motivator. And just look at, you know, everything from how many Nobel Prize winners to the kind of hope we have to export from, you know, the Jewish halls of study, and God willing, one day Israel should only have to worry about that kind of export, right? That's the Isaiah prophecy. So back to the answer, I think that whether you take it both directions, Jews and or non-Jews, you've got someone who feels like it needs to be exported.
Right, but I like that it's turning this on its head. This is applying that verse only to those who are worthy. And for the people who aren't, the other verse where now they're taking this verse and applying it to everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
A few thoughts rattling around my head. Lubavitcher, as far as I know, are reaching out to Jews, and they may believe that if Jews, you know, if all Jews kept Shabbos for a day, the world would change, but I don't have the sense that they're trying to impact the rest of the world. But I'm curious you raised the question of, is this meant to be Jews or meant to be
my
sense, the world, what would you...
The deep read of Hasidus, their philosophical and core texts, right, really allows for a read that all of the important avodah and all the important approaches of the Jewish people in terms of the mitzvot, as you said, like keeping Shabbat or beyond that, mitzvot in and of themselves, are theurgic tools that allow for movement of God to become more full of granting the world space to be in the holiness that it ultimately is envisioned with in mystical texts to begin with. In other words, allows God to fill in that space of the world for all people. And so when we call holiness down to the world through all those actions and activities, it's not just for the redemption of the Jewish people. but redemption of the entirety of the world.
I meant something else. They're not trying to teach Torah to non-Jews.
All right, so if you're talking about Leprat, like the detail run a class for outreach to either convert anyone and or just to inform people what the Jewish twist on the world is, I would not say that that's on their agenda. I would say what's on their agenda is to be in the public realm, a la the proliferation of the Hanukkah menorah, which has a very interesting place by way of their conception of their filling the public sphere with their presence, Jewish presence, Hasidus, and the hopes that all of this that we're talking about now fills the world with. And they've become politically active in a way that moves beyond spiritual, theurgic, or even ecstatic religious experience, right? And that to me is really interesting, but that's more a sociologist of religion approach than thinking about their own goals, right? That's the observer watching their relationships unfold in countries that are superpower countries, right? There's such a presence here in America, politically even, there's such a presence in Russia.
But it's also some very small countries where they're trying to protect Jews.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
I
wouldn't deny that. But to watch what that movement has done and is doing today, it's a very interesting question, just how much they're consciously involved in wanting to help change the world through Jewish means, whatever the means really are.
And totally different, what's the root of Yafutsu?
Yafutsu is...
It's paid
tzari tzari, lihit potsets. And generally it's understood to be that way. Whether or not there was a lahafitz in ancient Hebrew is a matter of question, and it means a little bit something different. And that's the...
Not there.
It's a question. That's a hefil form of a paid tzari tzari verb that drops the tzari and then moves it into hefil. So
it's complicated.
There is a question as to whether or not there was a feet's root, as I'm remembering the conversation now, but I think that the general accepted understanding is that it's paid tzadi tzadi.
There's also a well-known quote, Mal'ah ha'aretz de'ayit Adonai kamayim layam mechassim. Isn't that Yeshayahu? And that's super universal. That's the ultimate... spreading out.
Right. I mean, Or LaGoyim is fundamentally in the Tanakh already at the core of a Jewish philosophy that says you, with regard to the nations, are going to really play a part in the redemption of all nations on the face of the globe. And not only that, but we said at Sukkot this year, one of my sermons was all about how that was the universal holiday of offering korbanot on behalf of all of the nations of the world. And again, we talked about it being very chutzpahdik, that our work, our ritual work, our religious work, on behalf of all the other nations, whatever their religious, cultural affiliations were and their affinities were, that we did our sacrifice in thinking that, on their behalf, we're taking care of getting rid of all their guilt. Right?
The alternative, doesn't everybody just be selfish?
I mean, right, and that's what we talked about. The spirit of that activity really integrating that work into our own, hoping that it would make for better neighborly relations so that we could see a world that was really different and all this geopolitical roughhousing could stop in the ancient world. This is what the hope really was all about.
Yeah, so I think that Judaism is remarkable in this way. We take it for granted, but the idea that they talk about the other nations of the world means that they don't anticipate that everybody's going to be Jewish.
That's right.
And the same thing is, the exact same thing is about limited territoriality. It's not about the spread.
Right.
Our borders are incredibly well defined.
Right.
No more.
Right.
No more. So that's, I think people don't really stress this aspect of Judaism enough.
Absolutely.
That Judaism expects another world,
to coexist with it, and it expects a territoriality that will be limited.
No doubt, no doubt. When we did discuss it again back to Sukkot, I shared with you the great and wonderful point that Barry's making through the eyes and the language of Rabbi Sacks. Jonathan Sacks says, so why do I get half an hour on British television where the Archbishop of Canterbury and the royal family get 5 minutes at Christmas time? Because they know I'm not trying to convert anyone. And he says it in a funny way, but he's being very serious that we don't have this kind of approach, and that we did expect the world to be full of goyei ha'olam, or umot ha'olam, the peoples of the world. On that note, it did not stop the Reform leadership, when Pesach Schindler was the leader of the Reform movement a couple decades ago, to though really call for, in a sense that now will temper what we're talking about when it comes to outreach, he said, we ought to be inviting people who are potentially going to be looking at being intermarried to convert and do it more explicitly. Now, he was not as strong as some of the conservative movement leaders who said we ought to be really arguing for endogamy, first and foremost, in a more explicit way in America. And so marrying in became the trope more in the conservative movement than it did in the Reform movement at that point. But he was very much into inviting those who would be travelers to be like the Hager Asher B'Sharecha. And he used, instead of just the stranger who was within your gates, to say that that promotes a notion that the Ger, a convert, should be within your gates. And therefore he was more into being explicit about this outreach in that vein than others in the movement and others in the liberal Jewish world.
So if I wanted to be less charitable, I'd say I couldn't imagine a world in which there weren't going to be Shabbos goys.
There's your less charitable version.
The whole system would fall apart.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to come, if we're thirsty, to the water. That's where we leave it, in the next place. Amar Rabbi Chanina, Nimshalu Divrei Torah L'mayim. Why are the words of Torah compared to water? Dichtiv, as it's written, Choy Kol Tzame L'chu L'mayim. Everyone that's thirsty, go to water. Lomar Lecha, that's to teach you that what? Ma Mayim Manichim Makom Gavoa. Just as water leaves a high level, V'holchin L'makom Namuch, and goes to a lower level, Af Divrei Torah. So too with the words of Torah, Ein mitkayim in eila b'mi shedato shvela. Oh, you thought maybe that words of Torah they were going to say comes from heaven and comes down to the earth? No. Use the opportunity again to talk about the who of Torah, not the what of Torah. And so the who of Torah is the person who is retained only by one who is humble and who is namuch, who is low, who brings lowness into his life. So that humility really does make the difference. And it's kind of, as we've seen from last week to this week, hammering the point that your humility has everything to do with Torah truly being expressed. And in order for it to be shared, especially if someone's thirsty and they want to come and they want to sip of those words of Torah, that you need to do it with a certain level of humility. That's very powerful. Being that we've described Torah as words of water, and we've been talking about rains and fertile rains, now we'll even get more playful with what we compare Torah to by way of the potables in our lives. We can drink water, of course. We can also drink other potables. And that is Rama Rabbi Oshaya. Rabbi Oshaya says the following. Lama nimshalu divrei Torah l'shlosha mashkin halalu. You think it was only compared to one drink, one potable, one liquid. I'm going to tell you that Torah was compared to three things. B'mayim, uva yayin, uva chalav. That Torah really is compared to water, to wine, and to milk. Nice threesome here of wonderful liquids of the ancient world, which we'll explore in a minute, but let's read what it says about it. Brings you proof. Dichtiv, as it's written, Hoi, kol tzame l'chulamayim. There it is again, everyone's thirsty, go to water. Uchativ, it's also written further, L'chu shivru v'echolu u'l'chu shivru v'lo kesef u'v'lo machir yayin v'chalav. Go buy and eat, go buy wine and milk without money and at no cost. Meaning, that is, you know, go and don't, by the way, you don't have to pay any money. They're going to use this verse in other places to kind of say, wait a minute, you're charging people to come to a shiur? You're charging people to go learn Torah? No, no, no. It says that they should be getting it for, you know, nothing that they have to, quote-unquote, contribute monetarily. Then other cases, of course, they have to worry about how Chachamim and sages are going to be supported, so they can't completely leave out the equations. Then there are, you know, all kinds of discussions about what the sages and the Chachamim do by way of their own business opportunities in life and how they supported themselves through business opportunities, and so they're not directly getting paid. And then halakhic history will record how certain kinds of payments into Jewish educational institutions supports the people who otherwise would have been working at jobs just like yours, except since they can't work at jobs just like yours, we compensate in that way. So there's all kinds of questions about, you know, what we pay for, what we don't by way of Torah. Lomar lecha mashlo shamashkin halalu, just as these three liquids, ein mitkayim inela v'fachot shebekelim, are preserved only in the most inferior of vessels. In other words, very humble vessels. I wouldn't say inferior is good, the best word. But, you know, they can exist in humble vessels. Water, wine, and milk. So too, af divrei Torah, ein mitkayim inela b'mi shedato shvela, are only retained by someone who's a humble person. And really, they're not retained otherwise. Very famous story to come right after that in terms of the likening of, you know, Torah and wine. Kid Amrle Barte Le Kesar Le Rabbi Yeshua Ben Chananya. As the Caesar's daughter said to Rabbi Yeshua Ben Chananya, I chokhma mifo'ara b'chli mechowar? Whoa! And this could be about physical ugliness or simply like someone she thought was a little bit boorish. Right? Let's see. Whoa! Glorious wisdom, Torah, in such an ugly vessel? Amar La, he responded to her facetiously, Avich Rame Chamra Bifene Bifachra? Does your father put his wine in earthenware vessels, which are pretty lowly? Pretty simple? So the Caesar's wine in simple vessels, like the Torah is just in a simple-looking person, you know? Or maybe such an ugly person means more than just physically ugly, but let's just take it as that. Simpleton. Seems simple. Seems like a simpleton. Seems plain, at least. She says to him, Eil of Amai Nirme. But what else should we put the wine in? Right? You tell me my father keeps wine in earthen vessels. Amar La, he says to her, You who are nobility should put your wine in vessels of gold and silver. She went and said, this is what the rabbi told me. Huh, it's true, right? Earthenware vessels, they're so plain. Put them in gold and silver. We're the royalty around here. He put the wine in vessels of gold and silver, and it became sour. Atuva Amrule, when his servants came and told him that the wine had spoiled, Amar La Levarte, he asked his daughter, Man Amar La Hachi, who told you to do this? Amrale, she answered, Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya. Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya was the one who told me to do this. Kareuhu Amarle, his servants called for Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya. And they yank him into the Caesar's presence, right? You can just see the reality. They send the troops. He ruined the wine. He ruined the wine. And he asks him, the Caesar, Amai Amrat Lahachi, why did you tell my daughter to do this? Amar Le, Rabbi Yeshua answers him, Ki Hechid Amrali Amrila, as she spoke to me, so too did I suggest to her. Just wasn't right, right? So you should act on it. Ah. Caesar's daughter can't hold her tongue. V'ha ika shaperi de gamire. But aren't there, like, beautiful people? I know there are some beautiful people who are learned. I know there are some wonderful, beautiful, physically, incredibly wonderful, beautiful people who have Torah. That doesn't preclude scholarship. And Rabbi Yehoshua answers, Ehavusanu. If these handsome scholars would be detestable in appearance, Tafe Have Gamire, they would probably be even more learned. Now, you could take that on its very, very simplest level, like you get by with your good looks. You get by with your good looks. You know? Some people have it. That's what they get by with. Right? On the other hand, the real lesson here, right, is here you have wine in such a plain vessel. And it's good wine. Let's say it's good wine. But you're going to ruin it if you think that the kankan, if you think that the flask, you think that the vessel, the bottle, is really what makes all the difference. And so too with someone who's either, let's say it plainly, doesn't look like such a looker. Doesn't appear like someone who's so put together. You might know what it, you might have had this experience too. Maybe there is a person or two who has great Torah learning, has great learning in your field. Doesn't exactly look like she's fitting in so well, put together so nicely. Looks a little schleppy. Let's just leave it at that. Right? But the person really made it. The person really knows something. There's something to learn from the person. And somehow you're not able to learn as much from the person because somehow there's this, you know, even if it feels like general chemistry doesn't work, sometimes general chemistry doesn't feel like it works so well. Right? I mean, tell me if I'm really off base here and that you haven't had this experience. Like, I pretty shared experience though, right?
I think people who devote themselves to things tend to be people who care less about social interactions. You know, we talk about the spectrum and all of these things, but I think that that's really the unifying issue.
Yeah, you think?
So I'm just saying...
Because I know people who devote themselves have brilliant knowledge, and I could say that they're among the most menschy people I know, and they do social very well.
Yeah, but we're talking about, you know, we think about this in math and physics, in particular,
yeah,
where people who tend to be totally consumed with those subjects tend to be people who are less interested in social interaction.
You've suggested before that passages in the Gemara might be dealing with outlier personas, meaning like an elder. One time we were talking about elder care potentially in the Gemara. You think here we're talking about an address to a potential, you know, she's making a comment about Rabbanim she knows or sages she's encountered as part of this royal family where she would have had exposure to people who are really that, let's say, idiot savant, we used to say.
This seems very specific. Are there other citations that he was particularly unattractive? Is it said in the Talmud? Has he been referred to in other places that way?
You know, I was trying to remember. I did not look it up, but there's another passage in the Gemara called Ish HaMichuar, and it's the ugly.
You can't judge a book it's, by its cover.
It's the ugly soul. Right. There's another mission that runs just.
Don't look at the vessel. Don't look at the face. Look what is inside.
Right. So there is a lesson to that. And
but here it's implying that you have to be ugly to be good.
Well, that's the that's a really interesting question, right? Because what's that?
That's why the Jews are so.
What, right. I mean, what's that line trying to say? I mean, I could go home and say, "Thank God for that, I don't have such good looks," because you know, only that way could I really learn Torah, and have any chance of learning, you know, a fingernail's worth of what the sages learn.
Well, let me
turn this around without being so extremist to say you can't be good-looking if you're really focused on one thing. But if you're really focused on one thing, your career, your learning, you are going to pay a little bit less attention than somebody who is completely focused on their good looks. I mean, there's a...
Yeah, we have the image of the absent-minded professor, you know, who's less connected to social interaction.
Well, and the...
What?
Yes, difficult to connect to reality.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We do. I mean, those are stereotypes. All stereotypes.
Philosophically, we have a very different concept of what beauty is today than what... I think we're just talking apples and oranges here. I'm not sure getting into exactly...
What are you imagining that she's referring to?
I don't know that... I don't know what the concept of beauty was to them. Today, beauty seems to have really been, I guess, bastardized, and people's appearance.
Yeah, listen, I agree.
What makes for beauty today? I don't, you know.
I agree that there's probably a different conception of what is of ultimate beauty. I think she is reacting. Shot of the text to a person who, in whatever way, seems not to fit into the general category of pleasant to look at, right? And the other ugly man that's mentioned, and that's on page 20, and we'll see it again and down the line. I didn't want to read the story in parallel right now. I'm just going to remember the daf. That's not this rabbi, but there is a time when a rabbi makes the mistake of calling someone ugly. And then realizes that God creates everybody. And that's the philosophical moral lesson over there. Here it may be that your good looks could get in the way if you're not careful, because you might just rely on them. And B, it's not really the basis upon which you either become totally smart or you're able to, you know, quote-unquote, retain all that great knowledge, just like these silver beautiful vessels couldn't retain this, you know. That's the, I think, the focal point here, but your point about beauty is taken in the sense that we don't really know what the ugliness really was.
You know, they didn't know to say at that time, dumb blonde, you know, that's the problem. They didn't have
those jokes. They didn't have that cultural
milieu. You know, I don't know if they're talking here on external beauty or internal beauty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they're trying to compare, if they're talking about the external beauty or the human internal beauty. They don't specify the...
I think it's specified by the silver and gold
vessels. Yeah, yeah. But the silver gold can be beautiful outside, and you can put good wine in it, you will be beautiful inside.
Well, that's what I was saying, that the outer appearances, not even a matter of don't judge a book by its cover, it's a matter of if the you could have outside beauty, but that's no guarantee for any wisdom and any achievement internal. And you'd even be better, says this passage, to not necessarily be burdened with such a beautiful golden silver appearance.
I thought it was the humility that it's a kind of a link between the prior one. And so it's that kind of, even though this person doesn't look like they're wealthy and have a lot of you know, money, like the shine of silver and gold, that this more humble person has great value. But
you know what? It just may be about, we haven't brought up the money question in this. You may be really onto something, which is another thought that I was toying with, especially on the basis that, you know, they had this notion of this discussion that we were talking about before about dollars and who pays for what. So it could be about money in and of itself.
But it seems to me there are two different things. One is that kind of just genetically, physically unattractive, that there may have been something about the face or the body that was not, you know, traditionally attractive. Or the other thing that can be off-putting is maybe he wasn't clean or neat or tidy. You know, maybe there was something that was disheveled.
Unkempt
about him that was off-putting. And I think Judaism does not value being unkempt. It tells you to get a haircut before holidays. I mean, we are supposed to put ourselves together.
So that far, I don't think it's going. I think that the pshat here is that the simple jug is okay, but totally disheveled, no. Totally disheveled is not presenting.
What does the Zohar mean?
It really means ugly. It means ugly in appearance, it means ugly in
a common or poor quality.
In a common way. Again, not knowing exactly what was considered that beautiful, beautiful shape, figure, or look. And so the, between Eric's and Bobby's conception, that there's something just not in the, you know, whatever was typical of the time. It created some sense that this was not beautiful, like the gold or the silver vessel was beautiful.
Yeah, but what I meant is, can it mean
it can mean spoiled.
Ugly is in the sense of aesthetically ugly, or can it mean something common? In other words, just, yeah. I'm just curious what
I know what you mean. In terms of common and just like plain, no.
No, ugly, okay.
But it can mean also, in a certain sense, it could also mean spoiled. So, there's another possibility. Did you want to add something?
A different question about this story is, why was the rabbi talking to the Caesar's daughter, and how did the Caesar's daughter know so many learned people that she could challenge?
Great. I'm thinking this summer already, after reading this again. Thank you for that question, because I was thinking this summer, maybe I'm going to do like, the rabbi meets Caesar, right? This is a theme. This is a great theme in the Gemara. And in the Midrashic literature, and I think I'm thinking about it for, you know, a topical, one of those topical ones we were talking about for the summer of for this coming summer, to do a couple weeks. This is a common theme. It shows that the rabbis were both political and spiritual leaders, if you will. You know, political in the sense that they were in touch. We know the famous moment of Yochanan ben Zakkai speaking with, he calls Vespasian the emperor when he's still the general outside of Yerushalayim, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if he had a prophetic moment of seeing that in Rome the emperor would die and he would be made emperor, and this is what saved us and saved Yavne and the sages. We have other times where in Masechet Shabbat there's a learning going on about Jewish culture. It helps us establish our culture. Not only do they teach people how to keep Shabbos, but the Roman officials get a whiff of Shabbos delicacies.
But the thing about all those stories is it's the men. And what's interesting about this is that it's the rabbis meeting a foreign woman.
Yeah.
Being in talk.
Yeah. That's a great question as to whether or not there are other times that there are encounters with women, and when women are of royal stock and leadership stock, and when women are prostitutes or other in terms of categories.
If you do that class, it doesn't quite fit, but the story of God battling Titus is a fascinating story.
Do you remember where it is?
I can find it.
All right, find it.
You'll recognize it. He ends up dying, but it starts with a real battle between Titus and God.
Cool, I'd like to see that.
A few pages ago, we learned that Abraham sent Eliezer to bring Rivka.
Yes, we were talking about it.
And he had to check if she's beautiful enough.
That's right.
You know, or God forbid she's Chereshet or this or whatever. So there is a conflict in the team here that on one end, they want to select the good-looking ones.
Nice. That's a nice... Remember how I said watch for when the curriculum spirals back on itself, Ron? That's a very nice point about what was in this text before. That really plays out in a very different way. Yeah. Did you mark where that was? Did you remember where that was?
It's when you had the kids and you send them.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to take a look at that.
4A.
So here, on 4A, Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman said the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Shlosha Shalu Shalom Kahogan. We were talking about what they asked of God and what prayers would be fulfilled. I'm on 4A1. And Eliezer, what's that?
Page 4.
Yeah. 4A1. Eliezer says, "V'haya anar asher omar leha hatina chadech." He's looking for this wonderful match for Isaac, and let her tip over the jug, in other words, for the camels, in addition to me. Yacho afilu chigeret afilu suma. But it's possible that he meant to take even a lame or a blind girl, because what if she would have just done the act that he said, and she had these kinds of quote-unquote qualities of being in their eyes less than whole, let's say. I'm not sure that they use the term mechuar here, ugly, but...
No, you cannot say the chigeret is lo mechuar.
It doesn't say it explicitly on the page, so I wouldn't thrust the word, but I hear you. Heshivo kahogen. God responded to Eliezer in a proper manner anyway, in other words, and Rebecca was sent, meaning that she was not in this category of lame or blind, but she was sent. So Ron's read here, which is this nice, as we've called it, intertext, seeing that daf on 4a, at least in the sense of what's whole and what a person, you know, how we represent a person to be whole or not, we're worried in a certain way that a person is not whole if we were to worry that Rebecca was either blind or lame, right? Over here, a person can become...
To be Kogan, which means complete.
That's right. Over here, we don't have the same exact language, but taken in context of the type of people who are right for the builders of the Jewish people and who are potential, you know, imahot, avot, chachamim, people who established the Jewish world, who bring Torah into the world, here we want someone. He doesn't have to be exactly Kohogan. So it's an answer to that text, or that assertion, where what if she wasn't Kohogan? What if she wasn't whole? Well, here, you don't have to be whole in the way of beautiful, right? That's not what we're saying. When over there we were worried that maybe she was not up to the task in her time, because the generous read over there, if you remember, with Rebecca not being lame or blind, the generous read was, look, she had a big job to do. Isaac was still establishing the entire tribe. There were wells to dig. There was tents to move. The people were still on the move, et cetera, et cetera. We want someone who really was up for the task. And that could have been hagun as well. That's the way we interpreted that word back on page 4. But it's a really nice intertext.
Rabbi Judah the Prince was said to have a close relationship with Antoninus, who could have been...
Antoninus, yeah.
Could have been the Emperor Antoninus Pius, though it was more likely his famous friendship was either with Marcus Aurelius,
right,
Antoninus, or Antoninus, who was also called Caracalla. And so... At least he, and we visited Sephora, and I was really impressed with how Hellenic it was, or Roman Hellenic it was. And obviously they had cut a deal, so they had a very good relationship. But really it's not inconceivable that a rabbi could have entree to...
No doubt about it. And you have positions that are created in Babel, in Babylonia, called the Exilarch, and that person is the leader of the Jewish community. You know, we have offices to go encounter and meet with the leadership. We have dispatches of rabbis who go to Rome. So this is a really great topic. I have to decide whether or not I want to call it, like, you know, the rabbi meets the Caesar, or the rabbi and the Caesar walk into the circus, or something along these lines. But
you can do a parallel with Jacob meeting Pharaoh.
That's right. There you go. So let's now turn a little bit. I want to share a little bit of this with you, just on this little passage alone, right? All these lines of inquiry we've taken are really fantastic. I want to share with you what... This is a wonderful encyclopedia of Jewish food. That's a great resource, Gilmark's. Milk, because we have the three liquids. I figure I'll do a little bit more. We've done water a lot, but we haven't done milk and wine. So let's read a little bit about milk and wine from some of the great sources we have for food history. Milk, chalav in Hebrew, the word being a construct of chalev, fat, is the fluid secreted by the mammary glands of female mammals for the nourishment of their young. Goats and cow's milk have nearly identical levels of protein. But the ones we talk about in the ancient world are what? Goat milk was the milk that was normally made reference to, And I would just say, readers of texts uninitiated to the ancient world of the rabbis immediately think of cow's milk and don't really have in mind, oh yes, I'm talking about goat milk. And so, and goat milk is creamy. It makes wonderful pot cheese or a ricotta-like cheese with a coagulant, like fig juice. You don't need a chemical enzyme. You don't even need the dried rennet of an animal's stomach to make such a thing. You just take a fig, and they knew how to pick out a fig. And, of course, in Italy, the more often used fruit was the lemon, right, to curdle the ricotta and boil in the way that they did in the cheesecloth. So yeah, you have wonderful, wonderful, creamy goat milk ricotta-like cheese that's made in netting that was produced. And what's that?
Not like our goat cheese.
Not like the goat cheese we think of when we buy the tube of goat cheese. That's the point. And you can do that with your family at the recreation of the ancient Talmudic village and Tanakh village called Kfar Kedem in Hoshaya in Israel, if you're ever into actually making this yourself, which is the last place that I made it. So nomads who did not grow produce and were frequently out of reach of safe drinking water relied heavily on milk taken directly from the animal as an integral part of their diet. However, most people settled into urban areas in our ancient kind of scenarios. They had no direct access to animals and fresh milk, which spoils rather quickly without refrigeration. The Greeks, although they loved cheese, considered drinking fresh milk to be the exemplification of barbarian behavior. Turks called fresh milk sabah süt, morning milk, meaning that it came directly from the cow. In their area of the world, you could find dairy cows. Milk would generally sour in a matter of hours, whether it was from cows or goats, unless exposed to specific enzymes or bacteria that transformed its nature. Early in history, people learned to extend the life of milk by allowing it to become fermented by acid-producing bacteria, resulting in some of our favorite foods, including buttermilk, cheese, sour cream, yogurt, and kefir. Just an interesting by way of where their metaphor might go and what they associated with milk, right? The tastes of the ancient world that they associated with milk, and being that Torah could have many facets like that, a little bit more sour, a little bit more creamy, a little bit more like this, the way metaphors work in our lives, right? We have these experiences we're not consciously thinking of when someone says it's like milk, that all this comes into focus. But yes, it does work that way in our language reality, in our experience of the world, that we have to understand what kind of metaphor we're really making. Pasteurization doesn't come until the 1890s, as we know. So all those experiences with milk and trying to find vessels that are the best vessels to take care of it, they did that experimentation and they found that it was just the more plain vessels, right? Did you have something? Oh. So that's milk. And that's a fun food encyclopedia if you don't own it for your shelves.
Isn't that fun? Yeah. She gave him milk.
That's right. There's also stories of where milk plays an important role. Important role. Milk can be a food that really...
Hot milk. Hot milk.
Does she really give him milk at that point, or does she give him a milk product? This is a discussion that people have had. But it's pretty much straightforward by way of a shot. It's milk, right? And does milk make you somewhat sleepy?
Hot milk makes you
Some hot milk can really make you sleepy. So they knew of this in the ancient world.
That verse has the word butter. That verse I quoted, I think it goes into butter.
Yeah, which is why there's a debate. And there's a debate in there that the Shoresh is used. I'm not sure if it's the same verse or a little later on. All right, let's go to one. I think I've mentioned this book before, but maybe I've never brought it here. This is, Patrick McGovern wrote two books. This one is called Ancient Wine. And this one's called Uncorking the Past. And they're fantastic. This is the quest for wine, beer, and other alcoholic beverages and how humanity really accomplished those goals and how they started producing them in more sustainable ways, in better ways, without toxins, weeding out poisons, all that kind of stuff. This one is really talking about search for origins of ancient viticulture and really makes a deep dive into wine culture. And so just a little bit from chapter 9, the Holy Land's bounty. He does more than Israel in the book. A range of wines were available to the discerning Bronze Age or Iron Age connoisseur. At Lachish, an inland city of Judah, a jar was discovered with an inscription in early Semitic reading, wine made from black raisins. Drying grapes on the vine or spreading them out on mats in the sun concentrated the sugar, and very sweet wines could be made by this method. So I just, you know, I would have put an asterisk down. So Manischewitz is not the first. An early Iron Age jug from the hill country site of Shiloh was accompanied by a sieve filled with grapes. Either the grapes had been left in the wine and later filtered out, naturally drying to a raisin-like state during 3,000 years since they were buried, or they were already raisins in antiquity and were used to flavor the wine that was strained into bowls or other drinking vessels. Perhaps a kind of Tuscany vin santo, wine of the saints, was made in which the must was squeezed out of grapes, topped up with water in tightly sealed jars. Lachish, which was attacked and destroyed by Sanherib in 701 BCE, was surrounded by vineyards, which are still there for all to see in the basement rooms of the British Museum in London. The stone reliefs from Sanherib's palace at Nineveh show low-lying, unsupported vines lining the hills around the walled and turreted city as the Assyrian forces mount their attack. Other late Iron Age jugs and jars are inscribed with terms such as smoked wine and very dark wine. If we project later practice back into the past, we can understand smoked wine to mean either a cooked wine in which the wine was concentrated down to a sweet syrup, or a wine that was permanently or prematurely aged by being stored in a room above a fire where the smoke could permeate the wine. Now, both of those, which I talked about in one of my lectures at Pesach time, in memory of my father, Alav Shalom, were for the Holy Land and for ancient Jews a methodology that took hold that was a little bit different from other surrounding areas, even very close and nearby areas. We would cook the wine, thereby oftentimes killing the potential poisonous, what would be even continued along the path of fermentation, the mold and all kinds of spores that were very hazardous in the ancient world. And by creating fire that was hot enough and not only using it for glass production, remember, because hot enough fires in central kilns to bake bread didn't really have to get and keep these kind of cauldrons they had wine in, or vessels they had wine in boiling for a long time, that we would have the fire hot enough and we would use it for the actual wine, because also we liked the deep, dark red taste in our culture. That deep, dark, red, syrupy paste that had been cooked enough did not have the same potential poisonous properties than other wines in the area, including the Italian peninsula, in through Turkey, and over in the like Middle East in the Saudi Arabian peninsula.
But it also lost its alcohol, huh?
Well, in the sense that you had enough of that syrup, you could take a younger wine, which still had serious alcohol, mix it with the right amount, and plus put water in, depending on the kind of mix, and then you would constitute this glass that had enough alcoholic content, but really was overcome by the properties of the syrup.
Because, you know, you had the benefit of the alcohol as an antiseptic in terms of the safety. I mean, that's why beer was a lot safer than water in the ancient world. So the minute you boil it, you're going to lose that protective effect, but if you get it down to a very, very, you know, to a very small volume, it may be not all that welcoming to bacteria either, but it's interesting.
Right. When it came to diluting their wines down with water, the residents of ancient Jerusalem and Judah parted company with classical civilization. Why else would Isaiah cry out that the faithful city had become a whore, and compare its apostasy to silver, dross, and wine cut with water? The word for very dark Hebrew and Arabic kol, or chol, to describe the wine of a second vessel, a jug dated to about 700 BC from Hebron, conveys the same idea. Chol was the deep red eye shadow of antiquity, prepared from manganese oxide ore, and a highly appropriate term for a rich red wine. Ammonite wine from the central Transjordan Highlands was notoriously so strong that it induced the body to sin. Up the street from the winery in the port city of Ashkelon, the excavators found what they believed was a commercial outlet for the factory, a 7th century BC wine shop or wine bar. The building was strewn with storage jars of the Ashkelon type and dipper juglets for serving up the beverage. An ostracon found outside the front door of the shop might have been a merchant's invoice or a shopper's list. So material history. We've got all kinds of wine in that ancient world, safe for the Jewish people to drink, a grounded metaphor. We use it for both sacrificial purposes and for its safety, like beer was safer than some of the water sources they found. And the mix was the right sweetness, potentially for the fact that the sweeter wines didn't have as high an alcohol content and then wouldn't create as either much of a drowsiness or drunkenness, right? And that was a big worry. Because the Italian wine, according to Ben Sorer More, remember when we learned Masechet Sanhedrin and we were talking about the rebellious son?
Yayin Italki.
Right, that was Yayin Italki. And that was really potent stuff. And so what we're talking about here is not the real potent...
Maybe it was whiskey.
Not the real potent alcoholic wine. So the metaphor that's grounded, my point is this, the metaphor is not that it's great wine with all kinds of alcoholic, get your buzz on kind of properties. It really is wine that's safe to drink wine, that's very sweet, potentially, raisin-oriented even, and has at its core a depth to it that so you know that Torah and Torah study does as well. So I think that the metaphor works better when we understand the ancient sense of what they're talking about in the wine business. Okay. We are turning to, let's go to 7B1 on the left side. We're still in this wow zone that Meira brought us into last time, because we're going to have another claim, you know, how great a day, how great a day of rain is. All right. Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina said, Gadol Yom HaGeshamim, a day of rain is as great Kayom shenivra'u shamayim va'aretz, as the day on which heaven and earth were created. So you are to think of the incredible nature of creation on a day that you experience rain. Shene'emar, har'ifu shamayim mima'al ushchakim yizlu tzedek, the skies will shower from above and the heavens will rain down righteousness. Tiftach eretz, the earth will open up. V'yifru yeshav tzedakah, and salvation and charity will proliferate. Tatsmiach yachad, it will... The earth will cause salvation and charity to spring up together. Ani Hashem Berativ. I am Hashem who's created it. Berautam lo ne'amar. Beratim lo ne'amar. Now at the end of the verse it doesn't say I've created them, plural, the heavens. Ela Berativ. Rather it says I've created it. In other words, God uses rain as an indication of His greatness, of His greatness. So you have that wonderful comparison again, like it's the day of creation. And then what I said to you last time is, it's going to move from comparing these wonderful days of rain to the notion of, I know you've experienced not having enough rain. It's so wonderful that you could compare it to these because sometimes you lack rain. But don't think I'm just withholding it stam. As a matter of fact, in the ancient, and this is the ancient world, the reasons why I might withhold my rain are manifold, and they're mostly based in the fact that you're missing the mark, you're sinning. And so what we get now is a little bit of an insight. I think you can look at it this way, as to what sins the rabbis really held were among the most egregious sins. Because we know how important rain is from all that we've said about days of rain, right? But we also know that rain's not coming and it's not going to be here the day we need it because we've missed a mark. They're going to go through now and talk about the sins we've transgressed and why rain's withheld from us. But that says to me that these are for sure, you know, start of make a list of what you ought to really be careful about, maybe back to the notion of you have to be a Torah scholar who's hagun, who is na'e, who's pleasant and who's righteous and who takes seriously the scholarship and humility. But also, I think it's a message for all of Israel. What to avoid? What are the sins to avoid? And I think there's an interesting mix. It's not going to be so surprising to us what the sins are that are enumerated. We can pretty much say up front what we think might be on the list. But on the other hand, it's interesting to see what they're prioritizing in terms of letting us know what the sins are. So go to the right-hand side now. And it says 7b1 in the right-hand column, just below the bold line on top, the Gemara records a series of teachings that demonstrate how the provision of rain is associated with the spiritual status of the people. Rabbi Tanachum Bar Hanilai Amar, Ein Ageshamim Yordim, the rain doesn't fall, Eilayim Keinim Chalu Avinotehen Shel Yisrael, unless the sins of Israel have been forgiven. Chinemar Ratzita Hashem Artzecha, Hashem, you have favored your land with rain. Shavta Shvit Yaakov, you have returned the captivity of Jacob. Nasata Avon Amecha, you have forgiven the iniquity of your nation. Chisita Chol Hatatam Selah, you've covered up the entire sin, Selah. Alternative source for the teaching is Amar Le Ze'iri Medihavat L'Ravina. Ze'iri of Dihavat says to Ravina, Atu Mehacha Matnitula, you derive this teaching from that verse. We derive it from here. You hearken from the heavens and forgive the sin, etc., of your people. Right? In other words, the rain is only going to come to the land. So even before I get into the list of sins now, as we're going to jump in, I want to ask you, what do you think we can do with, we make of, we conceptualize, when it comes, how can we conceptualize, learn from, use to our refining our sensibilities, a punishment sin theology when we may not be believers in this quotient that says, if there's not enough rain in California and there's a drought, it's obviously for the sins of the Jewish people. Or take Israel, where there's not enough rain, and they're praying. And in general, we would say, I think theologically, that we don't buy into that notion that our sins cause God to withhold the rain, even as we read the Shema.
Well, we made a golden calf, and they stuck it in the desert for 40 years. That's a big sin that results in...
I understand the Peshat of the Torah. I'm talking about our theological outlooks. We're on the table. In other words, we're about to read passages that require us at least to understand that in the ancient world, they thought very seriously that their own sins could lead to God withholding rain from the land, right? Now, you may say, I could still see that in the world, that God somehow spiritually expects more from us, and if we would only do more, we would get more holiness, rain down from heaven. That's your position? But I'm imagining in the modern world, as readers of the Gemara, we're about to encounter something that we could simply just call historical, and that's interesting, right? And we see they're playing it out. But there's other approaches when punishment and sin theology, when we're facing either liturgy or text that suggests that that's what we need to consider in our own milieu, in our own outlooks, in our own time, right? In our own religious lives. So what do you, I'm asking you now just to break from the text for a minute, what do you do with punishment sin theology as you're reading it? You see it only as historical, a nod to the history of what our people believed, what people believe, religious people believed, or do you somehow potentially use it in a way that helps you refine an outlook in terms of moral life, in terms of religious life?
read it every day in the prayer book itself, right? We read it at the Shema.
We do.
So it's definitely right up there in terms of its centrality to what we every day say. So I think that there's a rooting in it. You know, we've had this discussion before, so I like to look at it from the reverse side, that humans have the capacity to compel God to make it rain by not sinning.
Right.
And so if you look at it in that way, we have enormous power to control our lives and not be at the mercy of forces that are beyond our control. So you can potentially flip it and put that positive spin on it.
Right, following that up, I mean, even today, the Israelis are leaders in irrigation and capturing water and all that. So there's a workaround. Even when there is sin and there's withholding, you use your ingenuity and you figure out a way.
That way you can keep on sinning.
Yeah. But it looks like today the more we sin, the more rain we get, because if we contaminate the atmosphere with all these gases and generate the warm and global warming, we'll get more typhoons and more
we'll get more water.
So the more we sin, we get more rain.
On average, we're getting a lot more drought.
We're getting a lot more, on average, we're getting a lot more drought than excess rain.
No, the water goes different places, but it's more water.
Well, but it's not a blessing. It's
right.
We're talking about...
Right, God sending those violent storms. We did also see...
Right.
Right, that Geshem Klala was part of the equation too. Right?
But it's water.
So it's true that the more we sin,
the worse
weather problem we see. I just want to point that out. Right, that's really what I was hoping would come out. That was where I was thinking as I started thinking about this passage of Gemara. To me, for whatever the notion is you want to say it's God quid pro quo, there's a lot of sin in the world towards the environment, and there's a lot of drought in the world. I held up, if you recall, the United States has a center that measures drought. I brought in the map. Those of you who were there, we looked one Shabbat at this map. The amount of drought in the world today, in the United States today, now that's not to say there aren't violent storms that are Geshem Shel Klala, but it is unbelievable in the last few years, the amount of drought, not only in the world, but Davka in our country.
From Northern California?
Yeah. Go to the West.
Yeah.
Go to the West in general. I just want to throw that in the mix before we start reading through these things. Because
this year we have had in New York, we have 65 inches of rain, which is 15 inches more than our average.
Yeah.
So I think it's hard to be linear here.
It's hard to be linear, it's true. The Gemara has, in addition to the way, the simpler way I was thinking of it, mentioned also storms that rage because of sin as well. You know, so it seems to me, though, that even if we're not exactly linear, there's a little bit deeper a cosmic connection than we want to make as moderns who kind of reject normally punishment sin theology.
Actually, one of the great, my favorite movie of all time, Chinatown, is about that. It's about water and control over water and who gets it and who doesn't get it and authority. It's fantastic.
Mm.
I think
when was that from?
70s?
I think I mentioned
one of the great movies after
this book about the Hydraulic Society before.
Which one?
There's a book called Oriental Despotism by a guy named Wick Vogel that I read back in college that had a big impact on me. But he starts with the concept of the Hydraulic Society. Hmm. And basically it's when water is a limited resource
you always have authoritarian government because of the problems in the distribution just centralizes power so enormously that you can't maintain anything. That book is exactly what came to mind when I saw Chinatown.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Oriental Despotism. But that I think is absolutely one of the lessons. And even we have one guy at Rockefeller who's like the world expert on how many people can live on Earth. I mean, that's what he does. He models that. Mm. the key factor is water that determines how many people can live on Earth.
And well, the Israelis came out last week or 2 weeks ago with a new invention that you have a pickup truck. On the back there is a machinery that can generate 500 liters, about 100 gallons every hour from air.
From the air.
Right, by doing condensation. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I saw this. Amazing, amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not industrial. It's really.
Right, right.
It's a nice trick.
It's beta.
If you talk about theologies that challenge me, but I'm not alone. This is a communal punishment, which is clearly going to be true of rain. It affects all of the community, but that makes it almost impossible that it's a direct reward and punishment. You use the phrase the spiritual state of the people as opposed to the individual. So that's an interesting comment on how do you, why do you punish the entire people rather than...
Yeah, and remember throughout our history, more articulated in rational terms during our era, but I think definitely exists in this realm that there is a spiritual state of the people and that the people as an entity on the earth far goes beyond the sum of its parts. Mm-hmm. And Rav Soloveitchik will speak about this in the notion of the individual and the community, one of his seminal articles about the concept of Klal Yisrael being a living organism on the earth and beyond individual Jews and their own capacities to either sin or do mitzvot. Right. I mean, the Midrash really.
Do you want to translate?
On Yom Kippur, we say
Hashem. Israel is responsible
we
for
say
one another.
Right. We're not. I'm not trying to efface, self-efface or erase the notion that there's a deep commitment to individualism within the tradition, and that each person then is obligated to one to the other. But there's also this thought that one could have that as a people on the face of the earth. That we are a unique organism that's way beyond any one individual and linking hands with another individual and linking hands with another, even beyond that, an entity on the earth. Now, that's a very different premise than even peoples of the earth through the ideas of anthropologists or sociologists would look and say, hey, this is a group of individuals who are committed to a culture and they create that. And this is just very different by way of thought that could exist in the eyes of God. To have such an entity at any given time that has a spiritual state of, let's say, more sin and transgression or purity and forgiveness.
Now my question is that a two-way street, the Arvin Sabbath said? In other words, because Dale raised the issue of communal versus individual responsibility, it's not just that we're responsible for one another in terms of taking care of one another. I'm asking, are we also not responsible to each other in terms of maintaining that there is responsibility on our shoulders to ensure the appropriate behavior of everybody else.
I think that's the point of that midrash you quoted. But beyond that, the hope that our Torah, thinking about the text we just read before, would be a Torah that we could share with others and lead others towards the right path, as opposed to keeping it levadecha. I think that the answer is yes, we have that obligation. So, just to get into the little first one here before we go tonight. Amar Rav Tanchum, Bered Rabbi Chia, Ish Kfar Akko. Rabbi Tanchum, the son of Rabbi Chia, the resident of Kfar Akko, says this. Ein Hageshemim Netzarin, rain is not withheld. Ela Im Kein Chayvu Sonehen Shel Yisrael Klaya. Unless the enemies of Israel, and that's a euphemism for those who are sinners among us, are condemned to destruction. Okay? So he's using that term euphemistically, saying those who are really, really not with the program, they have to be, really condemned. Shneemar, Siya Gam Hom Yigzalu Meimei Sheleg. The dry and the warm season steal the waters of the snowy season. Sheol Hatou. They have sinned to the depth. In other words, when the dry season is prolonged and the customary winter rains don't fall, it's evident that what? People have been condemned to destruction in the depths of Gehenom for their sins. Now this gets into a little bit of a touch there with life eternal, resurrection, Techiat HaMetim, one of the powers that God has to begin with, right? And so just to note that symbol was crashed on the kit. We had brought that issue of God's power to effect that one day resurrection at the beginning when we talked about God's keys on the ring, the powers that God has. God has the power to condemn them and should. And maybe by looking at why we don't have rain, this is really why, because we've allowed this to proliferate. An alternative source for the teaching, Marley, Z'iri midahava l'Ravina, Z'iri of the Havat said to Ravina, Atun haka matnitula, you derive that teaching from that verse, Anan mehecha matnitan la, we derive it from here, V'atar l'shamayim v'avarate mehecha, he'll restrain the heavens so there will be no rain, and you will swiftly perish, and that describes the punishment that God turns on those who are worshipping idols. So, idol worship, in the end of that small first opening serve to us about what really the sins are that we ought to be really concerned about, that is definitely the sin we're talking about. That allows the enemies of Israel, Sonehen Shel Yisrael, even if I call the Sonehen Shel Yisrael euphemistically those who are sinning in Israel, I also can say, now I understand why I use that term as the euphemism, right? Because internally, if I have a bunch of people worshiping the gods of those peoples around us, then those peoples around us will have the upper hand, and history will not turn our direction, it will turn their direction. So there's a geopolitical history of peoples and struggles within the Bible that's being, not being ignored, I think, in terms of the use of these verses within the limud, within the lesson. And also, it's a way of saying to those around the rabbinic time and culture, don't get infatuated with anybody else's set of gods over here. The Roman pantheon, the new ideas about who's coming to save you, early Christian ideas, Christendom's forming, right, the roots of it. Don't be so interested. Stay within the fray, and maybe rains will come in the right season.
Thank you.
Ruchim to you. Good to learn together.